fundamentally, you can't hate up close. And if you can get people to understand, not to explain or defend, but understand what's going down in scenarios where they don't really get it, then all of a sudden, it helps them make sense of the world. And that's actually what we're trying to do. The pledge I make to myself is when I'm just going to work because I got to go to work, I should change.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. This is U-Turns, the podcast about change. Today we're going to talk about physical change because it's so big and so important. And it's part of the shift that happens when shift happens. I'm Lisa Oz.
And I'm Jill Herzig.
And we are here today with a very special guest.
Yeah. We're here with Dr. Mehmet Oz. I think you know him?
Intimately.
Did you just curse? You said when shift happens?
Yeah, there's no cursing there.
Close.
Shift.
Well, I'm very happy to be here today. I actually came mainly to grade you guys. I'll be jotting down letter grades here for your performance.
Would you like
today.
A pen?
Can I have a pen right here.
Okay, don't scare marker. Us. You know, you don't freak us out.
It's smiley faces and everything.
All right. I don't know if I'm... Why do I bother with an introduction, huh?
Don't bother.
Cardiothoracic surgeon. Just won your... What number is it, Emmy, for the Dr. Oz show?
It's the ninth Emmy.
Ninth
but
Emmy.
More importantly, the best husband in the world.
Oh,
you can,
yes.
You can put that in your own words, please, Lisa.
Yeah. Continue the introduction, Lisa. I think you do know him.
Yeah, best husband in the world, right? What else?
I actually called my mother a lot. I get some verbiage from her, but she was at a... I don't know how to say this. A loss of words. She had very little to offer.
What did your children say when you called them and asked them?
They said what I was asking would be funny if a funny person asked it.
I know. This is the thing you two struggle with. You want to be known as funny, and Lisa wants the world to know that you were just not
other
funny.
People laugh at my jokes. I don't think they're patronizing me all the time. I know sometimes they are, but...
You know, Jill is actually impartial here.
Why do men laugh at my jokes?
Yeah,
I
laugh at your jokes, though, but I am such an easy mark. I will laugh at anything. Anything.
I actually laugh at half of his jokes. In fact, I'm embarrassed when we're in the booth doing the other podcast, and I laugh, and I think... Oh, that I said, my laugh sounds bad on tape. I need to be quiet, so I'm trying not
You're
to laugh
also,
at you.
It's on tape, so there's proof that you find him funny.
I do sometimes, just not when he's trying to be. He's way funnier when he's not trying to be funny.
So what topic are you going to pester me on?
I want to talk about U-turns and health. And, you know, when I was working as the editor-in-chief of your magazine with Lisa, who was the editor-at-large, we actually had a whole column that focused on U-turns, physical changes, but we also charted people's emotional changes. So I guess, I mean, my first question for you is, you know, it can be a chicken or an egg thing. Sometimes it seems to me a physical change that you make, a change that you make that's focused on your body, results in some kind of bigger life change, an emotional change, a big shift. But sometimes it's the other way around. I mean, you've seen this how many thousands of times?
I was expecting yes or no questions.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
It's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
The thing about physical transformations is that you can see them and everyone else can see them around you. So, usually. So, those types of changes are great because people can keep you accountable. Again, the challenge here is to augment your opportunities by, you know, getting smart, but also to keep people around you who can... And give you a hard time if you're not doing it. And being held accountable is a hugely valuable human asset.
And you think that really works, having people saying, come on, you didn't exercise today?
Well, it depends what kind of person you are.
I've always heard it's got to come from within.
So I'm one of those, there's two types of people. You know that there's actually two kinds of people. People who think they're two kinds of people and people who don't think they're two kinds of people. My kids will attest and Lisa will agree that I'm definitely a two kinds of people person. So... There's people who truly want you to do well and will do whatever they can to help you, even if you don't think they're helping you. But the energetic impact is still a positive one. So, yes, your mother may pester you, which you just ignore, but in the back of your mind, you don't really. Yeah, a good friend may know exactly how to nudge you in the right direction or to remove a trigger from you. And that all happens. It's much more subtle and hugely impactful. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who actually either don't care that much or paradoxically or perversely feel undermined when you thrive. That's why when people hang with people who are healthy, they get healthier. And when you hang with people who are not healthy, you gain weight. Best example, young married couples. The woman is almost always healthier than the man. And the woman will pick up the man's habits and get a little unhealthier. The man will pick up tips from the woman and get healthier. So they both sort of merge in the middle, which is why couples, as they get older, have similar health patterns. But right, didn't but the start
first,
that way.
I totally true. I've seen this many times. The first couple of years of marriage is kind of like the freshman 15 for women.
Well, and guys, too. They when their wives get pregnant, they get the dad bod.
Yeah.
not me, of course.
I find that very adorable.
Well, it is true.
No,
happens.
You probably tortured Lisa by becoming fitter than ever.
No,
he's never been that kind of husband.
No. In fact, I knew she was. I could tell she was pregnant when we were playing tennis. Because Lisa was captain of her team in college, and she would always smack me around. And I always thought of myself as competent, but I wasn't playing with her. And when she started hitting baseline shots, there were winners. It was because she was settling in, because as she got heavier, women put on weight down below, and they have to carry that child down below. So it sort of settled her into her shots. So that's why I knew she was pregnant. It was better than a pregnancy test, which are so out of date. Anyway,
better than that.
Some people are helpful and some people are not.
Now, external transformations, which are, you know, you lost weight, you got rid of your pimples, your hair looks better, whatever. That's all great because people can look at that and see that. Then there are the internal transformations, the really challenging ones. You got rid of your prediabetes, cope with your blood pressure better, address the way you feel, the fact that you have no energy. Those other people around you can't see as evidently. They can sense it, but you know. And one of the biggest challenges is people think they want to see the physical change, and they're not willing to acknowledge that the inner change is actually more important and happens the day you start changing. Mm-hmm. So it's actually good news. You don't have to do 3 months of, you know, paleo diet to lose the weight. The day you start your program, your body knows you're on it, and you will feel differently if you just give it time. But usually there's that little bit of detox that has to happen, the rebooting of the system, which takes a day or two or three, and that's really painful. And that withdrawal, which is almost like a drug addict would feel coming off the high, is a difficulty. And that, what you can tell, by the way, with food specifically, is if you feel really good after you eat a meal, that was real hunger. Mm-hmm. If you feel just, you know, back to baseline, almost calmness after you've eaten, it's actually
just relief rather than satisfaction.
Then you were actually dealing with an addiction. And much of the hunger, we think of hunger, belly cramps, et cetera, is actually withdrawal from whatever food you were on.
When you were talking about inner, I was thinking you were talking about motivational, because there are layers. There's the external visual. There's the biochemical that you're talking about.
I'm only two. There was external, internal. I'm not going to get the extra internal. That's three. And that's not very male
He'll
of
get
me.
Overwhelmed.
Guys are just two, you know, yes, no, blue, black, et cetera.
All right. For those of you out there, for people who know that there is another dimension besides just the biochemical and the visually obvious, there's also the psychological. And you've done this a lot on your show, where there's something has to change at a psychological, emotional level for people to make a physical change.
You have to realize you're worth it. That is the single biggest unifying idea I've wandered on the show.
And how does that happen for people? I mean, you know, we hear that. It's like a dime a dozen. Sorry, but to put a little texture on it.
I remember my 100th show. This is a long, long time ago. We're just, you know, finishing our 9th season. So that's, I don't know, 1,500 plus shows. But my 100th show, still a neophyte, and I was just trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. I still am, but at least I can sort of see the picture now. And we had Richard Simmons on. And he came on with 100 people who, like him, had all lost 100 pounds. Mm. That was the gimmick, right? 100th show, yeah. 100 people, 100 pounds lost. You can do the math. You don't need to, though, because it's irrelevant. And I thought it was 100 different reasons how they all lost their weight. And they all had wandered into this same concept of self-worth, self-esteem. But they all did it in different ways. So when you ask how do they actually do it, that's the challenge. You can do it because you understand the agility that you need to balance the stresses in your life. You can have it because you had an epiphany. You can have it because someone you love dearly finally got across to you. You can have a spiritual enlightenment. You could travel off to a remote part of the country or do it in your bathroom. There's many ways of getting there. Ultimately, you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And you're reminded of it in several ways, but I'm always nudged into it when I see young children. I don't know a single parent who doesn't want to show a new parent, who doesn't want to show a picture of their child and say, oh, isn't she beautiful? It was, mm-hmm. Oh, they're so beautiful. The reality is, all children are beautiful. I don't think I'm naive. I say every child, even children who have defects that require surgery. You look in their eyes, or you hear their voice. They're beautiful, and somehow we forget that. We start going through life, and you know, somewhere in your early teens, someone tells you you're not beautiful or not worth it, and that's really the big question to ask is who's the person who
told
you?
Or you tell yourself.
Or you tell yourself.
You look at social media.
Something.
Utterly to you produced that, images that aren't real
and then
at all.
You begin to spiral, yourself. And this deep ruminating part of our brain, the default mode, starts to kick in, which has huge survival benefit to the species, but doesn't have a happiness element to it.
Nope.
Like Lisa and I were stunned at an article we both looked at recently, looking at LSD and magic mushrooms, which is psilocybin.
Yeah.
And the fact, I didn't know this at all, but it turns out that profound changes occurred to real thought leaders. The man who was the founder of AA, who was an alcoholic, and his wife was Swedenborgian, which is Lisa's religion, which is really a beautiful way of looking at life. But, you know, she was influential. But he credits using LSD for getting off his alcohol.
Hmm.
And the guy's not he's not an addict. He tried it once, had an epiphany, because LSD shuts down on functional MRI scans, the default part of the brain. And it allowed him just to be released to experience consciousness as it truly happens.
Not that we're recommending people go out and do hallucinogens to change their behavior.
We're going to break now, so you can do that if you want.
Yeah. No,
just
you
a
can't.
Short little.
No, do not.
Little drop.
They're still illegal.
I'm advocating research.
We're going to go to break.
I've never done LSD.
You heard it here, folks. We'll be back in a second. Before the break, we were talking about LSD.
But I'm going to switch.
Yes, let's do that.
I
understand what he's saying
from potentially dangerous and illegal practices.
Okay, just to finish the discussion, because I was so rudely interrupted. Yeah. but I'm not advocating for LSD. I'm just pointing out the fact that there are fundamental parts of the brain that force us to ruminate.
You need that interruption. You need that psychic interruption to see.
Conceptually, you would do that through a faith that you have, just asking big questions, find stillness in your life. Some people have found it through drugs that do it for you, which should be studied, because the cure rate, according to this one piece anyway, but there's research behind this, on alcoholism and cigarette smoking is very, very high, much higher than drugs that we conventionally use. And you might think about, why is that so? Because it doesn't really work the way most drugs work. Most drugs, you have problem A, it solves problem A, and you're done. This goes to the root issue. Which is maybe the root issue of why we're unhappy. Because our brains are forced to perseverate on small, picky little things that allow our species to survive. So I'm not mad about it, not upset about it. Just acknowledge that it's true. But when next time you get up at 4 a.m. worried about something, ruminating over some little subtle thing that someone said that probably doesn't matter where the hill of beans, you should be reminded about the fact that it's, thank goodness you have that default system,
right.
But don't let it own your life.
Right. You have to know when to snip it.
Yeah.
So you have...
Snippet, that's a weird way of... that's used for like circumcisions and stuff. Snippet.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you mean by snippet?
In my mind, it's like a wire that you snip and you cut.
But you're an editor. You're talking to the power. Words are so powerful for you, and you're talking
but
to a surgeon.
But you're a surgeon, and so you think snip, and there's something bloody in it. And I'm not. I'm just thinking snip that wire, and the
electrician? I bet you're an editor.
Let her get her question out.
Here's my question.
You feel my pain, don't you?
You know, I've felt it for a while.
Are you kidding me? The two of you tag-teamed me for years, beat the heck out of me. This is my one chance of redemption.
Yeah, this is kind of delicious for us, actually. So you've had a super unusual career. You were a surgeon doing tons and tons of surgeries. You wound up on the Oprah show. Then you wound up with your own show. These were U-turns along the way. Were they uncomfortable? Were some of them a little painful and uncomfortable? At first, were you scared? People talk about fear a lot on this podcast.
Yeah. I don't know if it was fear. Part of it, giving credit to your co-host, was that Lisa had a much bigger vision for me than I had for me. So there's some power in bliss. You don't actually know what's happening. There was a beautiful study that Lisa's dad actually conducted. There were 7 surgeons at their hospital, and they wired them all up to see how their heartbeats would change due to the stress of surgery. Because heart surgery, he's a heart surgeon too. You know, things don't always go well. Blood starts spurting, you know, people jumping up and down. And so they wired all 7 of these people up. And the expectation was that the people who are the calmest would be the best surgeons. They did the study, and sure enough, that's absolutely the case, with one exception. One guy was just way off the chart calm. I mean, unflappable. And he was actually the worst surgeon because he had no idea he was about to kill the patient. I mean, zero concept. So not knowing what's going down is and innocently wandering into stuff is sometimes also part of the process, which means that you're sheltered from some of the anxiety. But there's, with that innocent bliss, is actually some opportunity. That's why young people make mistakes, because they don't know they're making mistakes, but they learn from that, and that's okay. That's why some brilliant ideas come up, because you had no idea you were about to do something crazy, but it turns out it was okay. It worked well. So in my life, I was moving from one painful experience into a space of fear. And like most people, I'm motivated by pain. And the big pain I was facing was that I treasured medicine. I love it. I still do. I still practice. But I realized that a lot of people I was operating on could have avoided the need for me to take a bandsaw to their chest if I could just have communicated some deep insights to them earlier. And it was Lisa who was the last voice I would hear as I fell asleep. I would hear my whining and start saying, well, listen, if they're not getting the message, don't blame them. It's you, because you're not giving it to them. You as like American medicine is not giving it to them. And we assumed as doctors that you sort of knew that diet mattered to your heart disease, right? And yes, at a high level, of course, everyone gets that. But what are you going to actually do about it if you're a doctor to make sure your patient knows that? And so we began talking about ideas. We made a show on Discovery called Second Opinion that I was very proud of. And I needed a guest to get it launched. Someone who's really a big name. So I called the biggest name of them all. I called Oprah. And thanks to Gail King, who I'll always credit with this, who was an angel and willing to just step out and say, this guy Oz has got something to say, even though he's not experienced.
She was a friend?
I had met her just because we were, you know, we both lived in New York City. I'd see her at events. And we were polite with each other, but she didn't owe me anything. There was no reason Gail King should have picked up the phone and said, hey, Oprah, next time in New York, we're going to get you in hair and makeup, which is not—
Had you ever talked to her about health, though?
No. I'm like, which one, Gail?
Yeah, Gail.
I talked to Gail only to get help for friends.
Okay.
That, you know, people who
But she knew you a little bit as a communicator about health.
I was probably the busiest heart surgeon in New York. And I would get interviewed a lot about topics. And I had started an integrative medicine center. Again, my eyes were open to that pulp world by Lisa and her family, who were, even though her father's a very well-known heart surgeon, he's the answer of a Trivial Pursuit question. How many people listening right now have played Trivial Pursuit and had the person they're playing against be the answer to the question, which is just patently unfair?
And, you knew you were in trouble.
Well,
there
was a question. This famous heart surgeon was the first to play rock music in the OR. Rolling Stone magazine called him Rock Doc. And that was my father-in-law, Gerald Lamole. So I
would have gotten that one.
Right.
Yeah, I just want to say.
But then, you know, you go to their house and, you know, there are herbs growing in the gardens, and the first thing they do is not run off and get medicines. They have other, they use medicines, but they have other tactics like food, which back then was not that unique.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I began making the show. Oprah came on, thank goodness. We had a good time. I was called back on her show. We did her show dozens and dozens of times. I don't know, 60, 70 times at least. I learned a lot from her. Lisa would conspire with Oprah to make strategies for how to make what I had to offer more palatable to the American public.
So it was a learning curve for you?
For sure.
But, like a hockey stick or gradual, or how would you describe
it? It's more like a bungee cord jump. when you go on the Oprah show, just to give you an example of how naive I was, I didn't want to mess up my nice clothes. So I would wear those nice clothes to Chicago. I'm at Columbia University here in New York. So I go to Chicago, I wear my nice clothes because I'm going to be on a plane. I want to look good to people around me.
Yeah.
And then I go on the stage and I'd have organs, which I would carry in an Igloo cooler, which is the easiest way to carry organs, by the way. So when people are walking with Igloo coolers, it could be beer, cold cuts, or organs. And I was always worried that someone was going to think I was Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes, yeah, seriously.
Yeah, because they go through the x-ray and there's a heart.
Femur, the jawbone. And
I cannot imagine being the person working the x-ray that day pancreas slides through.
Oh, pancreas doesn't show up, but the spine does. So dismantled body parts. And I had Oprah write me a little note saying, hey, this guy Oz is legit. Don't arrest him. So I get there, but I get on the stage. This is the point of the story. And I get out of my clothes and put on my $14 cotton scrubs, because that way they won't get, if they get organ juice on them, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Naively not recognizing they're going to be 15, 20 million people watching you that day on the show. And it's that level of insight that I brought to the program.
It became a thing, honey.
Yeah, well, I know, accidentally, but I didn't know anything.
Because they said, just come ahead.
Well, and then
Actually, we are, okay. This is the Apocrypha. We actually had you in organs when we were doing that on Second Opinion Amendment. You were just replicating the segment.
I used organs for the show Lisa executive produced that Oprah came on. That's how the idea itself.
That's how the organ thing started.
No, but that's how, he wore scrubs then, too.
He wore scrubs the whole time because we were just underlining that this guy's telling you about some integrative ways of getting better, like what foods to eat. But he is wearing scrubs, so he must be a doctor. That was just like
you also kept from ruining your best suit.
Also,
I feel like I want to.
But you ask how fast
I learned.
Get some
scrubs for cooking or something.
Exactly, but that you learn because someone throws you in the pond and a couple people give you a little boost up so you don't drown immediately. But you do have to swim eventually.
Yeah,
and
you approach. I was just going to say you approach new tasks the way that Jill does. You guys aren't that dissimilar. You're hoop jumpers, and I've told Jill this many times. Like,
well, she went to Yale, which is the second best school in the Ivies.
I'm not even going to take that bait, buddy. Yeah.
but when you're faced with a new opportunity or challenge, you just put your head down and you just bulldoze through it. Mem is the same way. I watched how hard—
But sometimes to my detriment. I mean, I have to say, there are times when— The effort kills the spark.
Well, that's what I'm wondering with Mehmet. When I first met him, he was in medical school, and literally we would have dates where I would sit and watch him practice tying knots for 45 minutes before we would, like, have anything to eat or talk or—
I'm a great knot thrower.
He is really good at knots now. Not so good at dates, I must say.
I do all the sewing at home.
There's no sewing at home. but my question for you is, when you've— Has there been a time where, like Jill's experiencing now, where life has kind of thrown a curveball?
Yeah.
It's not just a progression like going from Red Book to Our Magazine.
No, no,
where you
no.
just work harder and adjust.
No, there was one day off between those. Yeah. This is I'm on, 10 months
so
without—
So in your life, is there a time where you've actually made a psychological U-turn, not just this is a new task, I will do the same thing I've always done and work harder. Is there a time we've had to like rethink your toolbox?
Yes, but just if I can brag on Jill for 1 second, Jill is arguably the premier editor in the country. So the fact that you're doing this podcast and you're not doing it because you've got a couple extra free seconds is important. And when you
I'm in this soup with everybody else, and I'm just finding it. One of the things I learned working for you was whatever it is, get intensely curious about it. And I'm so as sort of painful and weird as this period in my life is, I am. Very curious about it, and I'm talking to people. We're talking to people.
When we recruited you to come over to the Good Life magazine, it was a huge coup for us. And the fact you took off 24 hours was representative, emblematic of how much in demand you are, which is why your experience through this process, I think, is invaluable. And Lisa, like everybody else on the planet, has ups and downs, and I have mine. So I'll share my thoughts. But I remember when I was very young, I was playing sports, and I just couldn't deal with failure. I'd lose my temper. I'd throw up and down. It's unfair. I should never, ever lose at anything. And, the old adage was, show me a good loser and I'll just show you a loser.
I've heard that before in our house.
I just couldn't deal with them. Well, I mean, I do use it still. I think the fire in my belly was more painful. I sensed more pain than the average person would. I still feel that right now. But I also recognize that the failure itself really wasn't the issue. The real failure would be if I didn't ask the right questions, if I didn't do what I needed to do. And it made me a little bit bolder. I'm still, like most people, a coward when it comes down to the big things you really care about. You don't want to risk stuff that you work so hard to build up, relationships, positions and jobs and things that you've earned. But I also, every once in a while, will sit back. And I do try to do this every 7 years. We talk about that sort of magic number, which I'll come back to in a second. But I think you have to challenge whether you're asking the right questions. Because I'm very much a rat. I was born the year of the rat in the Chinese horoscope. I will race through whatever maze you put in front of me darn fast. And I'll probably beat you to the end of it. But the question you should be asking is, why are you running in a maze? What's the point? And when you're going in the wrong direction, going backwards is actually progress. And I won't realize that. And I have to literally put my head up, look outside the maze for a second, and reevaluate what I'm doing. So in middle school, I didn't like I was playing football, and I didn't want to be at the bottom of the pile. You ever wonder what happens to the bottom of a football pile? People push on you, they shove on you, they needle your back. Maybe you can't breathe. And I actually didn't know because I'd never been in the bottom of a pile. And I remember there was this crazy play that happened, and I got stuck in the very bottom of the pile. I mean, there were 10 people on top of me. And it was okay. Crazily, wackily, it didn't actually matter that I was at the bottom of the pile. I could breathe just fine. Nobody was purposely needling me because they knew that if they were in the bottom, I could do it to them. And I realized that if I just embraced this monster that I feared so badly, it wasn't nearly as bad. And that's sort of been an ongoing theme of my life. Find the thing I fear the most, try to embrace it, recognize it's going to hurt, and sometimes it'll shove you off. But generally speaking, you'll feel better for having done it.
Yeah.
So most of the things I fear a lot, I don't like heights at all. I'll get close enough to the edge of a building where I feel my testicles get sucked into the belly. I mean, I don't.
But so that's what happens to men.
Exactly. I know. That pole, he jumped off a telephone pole when we were with Tony Robbins.
Yeah, Tony Robbins forced me to go up on a, we were in Fiji where he has a little place there. And one of his little tricks is he gets you to climb up on a pole. And you, and by the way,
just physically ill?
Yes.
He was.
You don't just jump off the pole. You jump up, you climb to the top
into
of the pole,
the air.
Stand on the top of the pole so there's nothing holding you. Then you have to jump into a trapeze.
And you're wearing something to keep
they
you from
dying. They have a little harness
dying.
On you.
It's not a very convincing harness. And it looks like it's going to really hurt if you have to use it. And you've got to jump out and catch this little trapeze. And everyone's watching. Back to the issue of having people who are supportive of you.
Yeah.
And most of them are not yelling catcalls at you or criticize. They're saying, listen, we're next. Show us how to do it. Lead us. Or we just
you
did
were
it.
Watching
you
this, Lisa?
No, I was next to him on the higher pole.
Yeah. She has no problem, by the way. She's like a little goat climbing up there.
And so you did it.
I did it. I have video. I'm going to put it up on the air. It'll be on DrOz.com right after this podcast.
No, look at it on our episode notes. We'll,
exactly.
We'll post that. All right. We'll be right back.
Before the break, we were talking about my husband overcoming his fears. And you wanted to ask Joe about the most recent time he'd done that, pretty much.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you, you said that it sort of goes in 7-year cycles, and every 7 years you try and pick your head up and really take a look at your life and the direction you're going in. When was the last time you did that? How long do you have until your next one?
I should mention the doors are locked here. I've been trying to get out of this room for 25 minutes. About 2 years ago, I went through a whole process, 3 years maybe, where I wasn't sure that what I was doing was changing America in the way. I'm in the change business. I want to change stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not alone. A lot of folks out there listening are. But I know, I think I know how to do it the best with my skill sets. And I thought maybe I'd missed the boat, that I had shifted or the country had shifted in a way that what I had to offer no longer was best suited with the show. And I'm passionate about this program I make. I work so hard on it. We've got a dedicated team of 100 plus people who are equally desirous of changing the country in the way I feel we can. And I started to look around to see what else we could do differently. Because when we started the program, people couldn't spell quinoa. I remember putting it up on a big monitor and say, it's a Q in quinoa or kale. Say it with me, kale. So that's not where we are now.
No.
And so we have to reinvent ourselves the way the country needs to. And so a couple years ago, we began doing this in a very earnest way and realizing that our brand was trust. My brand is trust. And if you trust what I have to offer you, then you'll trust me to take you in areas beyond just spelling quinoa correctly. And it led us to a lot more investigative work, which can be troublesome because when you investigate stuff, people don't like what you're investigating. They don't always like your answers. But sometimes people at least need to be educated with the facts as you see them. Try and be as fair as you can about it.
Yeah.
And let people push and shove to find light, because that's if you can shine light in all the right places, that's the best way of dealing with pestilence and illness. And we went through that process. It was painful, and we ended up changing the show a bit, I think, to make it even more correctly targeted. We're doing, for example, true crime.
Yeah.
In part because there's forensics issues that come up a lot. People are very curious about how you use DNA to diagnose a problem, or what the heck, what is going on psychologically with a woman who puts 13 of her kids in a prison-like setting. Why would you bother having the kids if you're going to treat them like that?
How can this be? How can someone's mind?
Fundamentally, you can't hate up close. And if you can get people to understand, not to explain or defend, but understand what's going down in scenarios where they don't really get it, then all of a sudden that makes them, it helps them make sense of the world. And that's actually what we're trying to do. And that has really re-stimulated me, and I'm passionate about it. And the pledge I make to myself is when I'm just going to work because I got to go to work, I should change because time is not my friend anymore.
Mm,
right? Yeah. Time was my friend when I was 20. Now time is, you're looking at horizons and you think, well, how many more years can you own the bully pulpit? And it would be a shame to waste it. That was actually the biggest failure to me is having the opportunity to help people and change the right way and not using it correctly. That will be a real tragedy. And we see it. Not on purpose. People don't mess up because they want to. They mess up because they were unwilling to embrace the challenges in their life. And we should be all cautious of not making that exact same mistake in our lives.
You're talking about change. And one of the things that I think we've seen through this podcast is that you need to have some mental resilience to be able to make change. And that is one of the core tenets of HealthCore, our children's foundation that we founded about 15 years ago now.
Yeah, 15 years.
Can you talk about that a little bit and the whole role that mental resilience plays in health change?
Another example of how you have to adjust what you're doing to make sure you stay connected. Again, I'll give that seven-year number again. By the way, I met Lisa. She's exactly the woman I wanted her to be.
I mean, a 54-year-old, yes. Middle-aged,
when we first met, when she was 20.
And she still is today.
Yeah, and from the moment I met her, she was trying to change and improve herself. Now, I thought I was the perfect guy. I mean, why would I bother changing?
But maybe that's actually what you fell in love with, right? That's driving that change.
It's possible, although I just was, I wasn't that complicated. I was very simple.
You want to know how you people are simple. Haven't changed? You haven't changed telling this story.
Yes, but it's true.
And wait, I have a question. Guess how I haven't changed?
How you haven't changed?
I haven't changed in that I haven't started to like it or agree with it. I haven't stopped asking you not to go down this cliche road.
It's the first time she said that today.
Today. Exactly.
Anyway, let me finish the story for the millions and millions of people who want to hear the story. I was perfect.
And, just the way you
and
were.
And Lisa wanted to change me from day one. So you have these two opposing factions. And I think that's true in most of the relationships. We find what we want to do. It's perfect for us. And not realizing that we're changing and it is changing or not. And we have to adjust accordingly. And I struggle with this a lot in HealthCore because HealthCore is about getting, it's like the Peace Corps. So it's a bunch of young, energetic college grads, recent grads who are educated about health and how to teach and then put in the school systems around the country. So they're not in Botswana building dams like the Peace Corps. They're actually in schools being mentors and teaching physical ed or—
They make incredible changes. We did a story on it in the magazine. Right. They touch
I love the passion. But when HealthCore first started, childhood obesity was a big problem. We needed to get in there and make an adjustment. We have peer-reviewed, published papers on just that. We taught kids what to do. Then we showed that they did what they knew to do because we knew kids. Look, that's why advertisers go after kids, right? They know that information, when they get it, will change them. That's why they don't try to educate 50-year-olds. They try to educate 15-year-olds. That's why the tobacco industry goes after young people. The vapors go after them. It's also why, detergent companies go after young people. So we knew that was going to be effective. And then we finally showed that they actually got healthier if they wanted to lose weight. They lost weight because of what HealthCore was teaching. But I also began to realize that it wasn't so much about the food you're eating or the activity you were doing or not doing. It was really about mental resilience, to Lisa's point. And if you can get people to become tough enough to control what's happening inside their bodies, they'll also have the wisdom and the fortitude to change what's happening outside their bodies, which is why fundamentally health is so important because it's the one place where no one else actually controls it. They may make it harder for you if you live in a food desert. They may make it more difficult if the healthy foods are expensive. But at its very core, the healthiest things you do, you control. And they're generally affordable. And so if you take advantage of that wisdom and recognize that it's emblematic of the role you're going to play in the world around you, then you'll act on it. And that's the core of HealthCore. It's actually the core of why I am passionate about health and its spread. But I think it's why most people listening right now to this podcast generally care about their health, and they should even more if they realize that people around them are trying to copy them. If they can be avatars for health, if they can carry the banner high, even though it's difficult, they'll shine a light on that serpentine path towards healing.
As you said, people get healthier when they're around other healthy people. You can be one of those healthy people that has that influence. Resilience with your own kids, a question for both of you. How have you taught them that? Exactly the same way it's taught in HealthCore? Or
spanking, usually.
Someone's going to quote you now and think that Dr. Oz advocates spanking.
Are you kidding? Oliver's twice my size now.
This is true.
It used to be for 13, 14 years of his existence, it was, Mimic, get off your son. You're going to hurt him. And then literally over one summer, Oliver, get off your father. You're going to hurt him.
The wrestling matches, the potentially dangerous wrestling
matches.
Well,
that's how I wake him up in the morning. You wrestle him. When Lisa says, go wake up, all you have to. How else do you wake children up?
That's how you teach resilience. You just body jump
slam
on them.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so.
No, part of it, I think,
what we try to do is not that you want your kid to struggle, but they need to struggle. And, you know, I always talk about parenting, and I think Mema does too. Like, it's like being a bird mother or father. You've got to keep the nest warm and protect them. And then at some point, you got to push them out and let them, push them from not too high a height so they don't crash, but let them flap, learn how to flap their wings. So don't overprotect them.
Give
them
resilience. Best advice that I ever heard. It's something that I think a lot of the listeners will remember, is when you give your kids something that you didn't have when you were growing up, you're taking from them something you did have. Every difficult event that you experience as a young person that you don't let your kids experience, you don't want to have them have all of them because some of them are really painful, but you are taking away from them something you learned. I'll give a mundane example. I'm Turkish origin, as most people know, and Turkey is about an 11-hour flight from here, direct nonstop flights. When I was a kid, that wasn't the case. We would fly to some European country, and I'd been to every capital in Europe because of this, literally before, you know, the 12 hours that you're waiting in the airport for the next plane to pick you up. Then you go from that airport to Bulgaria or something, and then you take a bus from Sofia, Bulgaria, to Istanbul across a border, and 24 hours later, you. So it was like a, you know, one of those old trips.
Yeah.
It was, you know, you wouldn't go for a week because it took you half a week to get there.
Yeah.
Painful, horrible, fighting with my parents, my sister, miserable. But I learned a lot. You did things and saw things you could never imagine. So now when the kids get in, you know, fly, go to JFK and take the 11-hour flight to Turkey, they don't get all that experience. Now, they probably don't want it either.
Yeah.
I didn't certainly enjoy going through it. But I learned and saw things I could never imagine.
Yeah, and your great-grandfather, Mehmet, said, when we came into Turkey, we went across the Asian steppes on our horses and our caravan. It took us 4 weeks. So it's relative.
So you talked about that nest. Your nest, which was extremely full, four kids, lots of grandkids around. It's a lot emptier now. How are you guys doing? How you doing?
Have you noticed, honey?
I entertain her so well. Just took care of her. Actually, you know what? It's a circle of life. When Daphne, the oldest one, has three grandkids now, they fill the house real fast when they come in. And Oliver just came back from college. So we look for different things, having the kids home. I don't complain about them messing up the room quite as much, leaving the lights on, because they're not there to do those things, and it bothers me when they're not there to do those things.
Yeah.
I just look for ways of giving them a hard time. There's plenty of ways of doing it.
I have to say, I have a 16 and 18-year-old, so my daughter's going to go to college in the fall. And one of the things that has helped, it really started as soon as we were in the horrible, you know, SAT process. And, you know, as soon as that college process started, I thought to myself, all these things that are driving me crazy about the kids, I'm going to miss it.
Yeah,
I'm going to miss it when they're not there, when I'm not wandering around the house, muttering under my breath, turning off their lights, tripping over their backpacks. I'm going to miss it. You're missing it a little bit, huh?
You do, but
yeah,
you know what? It's that U-turn you're speaking about. The U-turns always take you back where you came from. You just call it turn. I guess it misses the U part, doesn't it?
It does. The U, the Y-O-U, is very important. Mehmet, thank you so
much
for joining
us. I'm going to give you guys
grades. Yeah, we do.
Yes, so there's three levels of no. You guys are great. I know you would be.
So this guy, Mehmet Oz, you can find him. He has a show called The Dr. Oz Show. You can find that.
He has his own podcast now, too.
And a podcast, and thedroozshow.com is full of fascinating content.
Yes, tell us your change stories at U-Turns Podcast. See you next time.